So you can go ahead and open up your Bibles to Genesis chapter 16. We are continuing in a series through the book of Genesis, looking at the stories through the lens of the gospel. So pointing out where these stories point us to Jesus Christ. Now let me ask you, as we begin chapter 16, have you ever tried to help with something and only made it worse? And wives, don't be pointing at your husbands right now. I read about Albert Einstein's first son, his oldest son, named Hans. And when Hans was young, his dad was working in his home office on a math problem. By the way, that's what I do all the time in my home office. I have math problems up on the board, but anyway, that's another story. And so his dad stepped out of the office to go do something. And while he did that, Hans walked in and started writing his own equation on the chalkboard. And so as he did this, he saw his dad's work up there. He began copying what his dad was doing. But since he was a child, I read that he didn't copy it very well. And so he mixed up equations and he added wrong numbers, and it was just a big jumbled mess of numbers and all sorts of other things. And so by the time his father walked in to the office, young Hans had this nonsensical equation, and Albert Einstein, the great Albert Einstein, looked at it, and Hans told him that he was trying to help his father out. And so Albert burst out laughing as he read the equation, because it was nonsense. Now, luckily for Hans, he didn't mess up his father's equation. And Albert thought what he did was cute, because he saw it as a artistic representation of his work. And so Hans here tried to help, but in the end, what he did was just absolute nonsense. And in our passage today, we're going to be looking at another story of Abram and Sarai, but we're going to see how they try to help out God. And in doing so, they're going to create a massive mess, not just for themselves, but for many generations after that. And too often, we think that God needs our help. We think that we need to get in there and God's not doing it our way. So we grow impatient, and we decide to act on our own. And when we do this, we never make things better. Now, up until this point in Genesis, if you're new with us today, we've been following this man named Abram, and Abram was called to leave his country and go to a distant land. He traveled probably about 1,500 miles with his family. And Abram then was told before he left that he would become a great nation. But the problem was that he had no kids and his wife was not able to have any kids. Even worse, they were well past the age of having kids. So at the beginning of chapter 16, which we'll be looking at in a moment, Abram is about 85 years old, and Sarai, his wife, is about 75 years old. Now, just a show of hands, how many of you were conceived by parents who were 75 years old? No one? No one here. Okay. I looked it up on Google, in case you were wondering, and the oldest person recorded to have a child is a lady from India who gave birth to twins at the age of 74. So, folks here, it's never too late. Now, this was through in vitro fertilization. And in Genesis 16, there was no IVF. There was none of that. And so there was no humanly way that Sarai was going to have a baby at this point, even though she was told that they would be having a baby. And so there's no doubt that this is weighing on their minds many, many years, 10 to 13 years later. And so in Genesis 12 and other places, God tells him he's going to have an heir. But there's no way they can have an heir. And so with that in mind, surely God must need help. And so this leads us to the start of our passage in Genesis 16:1. So let me go ahead and here's our main point here, that bad things happen when we think that we know better than God. So let's go ahead and let's take a look at our passage starting in verse 1. Now Sarai, Abram's wife, had borne him no children. She had a female Egyptian servant whose name was Hagar. By the way, let me stop there. Where would an Egyptian maidservant come from in their family? Well, from Egypt. Thank you. Yeah. And how did they get one from Egypt? Well, they had been there against God's will. They had gone down there, and the Pharaoh had given Abram a bunch of servants, we read, a number of chapters ago. So most likely, this is where Hagar came from. And it's interesting to think about that their sinfulness from a few chapters ago is now going to catch up with them and cause more problems here in a moment. Verse 2. And Sarai said to Abram, "Behold now, the Lord has prevented me from bearing children. Go into my servant. It may be that I shall obtain children by her." It's getting hot in here now. As I've already said, Sarai and Abram have been waiting a long time for this promise to come true, most likely about 13 years. And so let's give it to them that it's reasonable to begin to wonder what God is doing here if he hasn't caused this promise to come true in this amount of time. It made me think of when my family and I moved up here. This is, by the way, I'm going to give you a hypothetical situation, not a real situation. We moved up here, and we love our little town that we live in, and we love our little house. But when we moved back in 2017, we moved from out of state, so it was hard finding a house. And so we ended up in a house, by the way, with a pastor's salary, not a lot of options here. And so all that to say that the house that we moved into doesn't have a garage, and it doesn't have a master bathroom for the parents. And so every night we go in, get ready for bed, and you would think it's like Walmart on Black Friday morning as everyone's crowding in there trying to get into the sink or to the toothbrushes or to the mirror trying to find their spot. And so it's a little crazy there, and we would love to have another bathroom. And so hypothetically speaking, let's say that someone here in a church, some wealthy person comes up to me one day and he says, "Kyle, I think you're an amazing pastor. And you're handsome and you're muscular and you're smart." This is my hypothetical situation, so come on. And so he decides, he says, "I'm going to give you enough money to build a bathroom and a garage for your house." And I was so excited. And he didn't do anything that week. So the next week, I see him in church, and I'm like this to him. You know, I wave to him, and he waves back, and there's nothing. So next week, I go up. I say, "Hi, how's it going?" And he's, you know, we chat for a little while, and still nothing. He says nothing about this offer, this promise that he made. And this goes on for weeks, and then the weeks turn into months, and the months turn into years. Now, at some point, would it be reasonable for me to think that he's not going to give what he promised? That I'm not getting that master bathroom that he promised he would give me? And I know this is a different situation because we're talking in Genesis 16 of God promising something, but hopefully you get a small glimpse of what's going on here, that 13 or so years after the promise, nothing has happened. So this is the frustration that Hagar that Sarai and Abram are going through. So one day, Sarai walks in with this plan for Abram. And the plan is for Abram to marry Hagar, the servant, and then to have a kid through her. And this, by the way, this was a custom from surrounding cultures was not a custom in their culture by given by God. So this was not something that God told them to do. But so she's being influenced by the cultures around her. And surely, though, Abram, the man of faith, would say no to a silly proposal like this. Surely he wouldn't listen. After all, he's in Hebrews 11. He's listed as one of these great men of faith. But what do we see instead? Just like Adam listened to bad advice from his wife, Abram now does the same. Second part of verse 2. And Abram listened to the voice of Sarai. So after Abram had lived 10 years in the land of Canaan, Sarai, Abram's wife, took Hagar, the Egyptian, her servant, and gave her to Abram, her husband, as a wife. And he went into Hagar, and she conceived. So to make this plan happen, he had to become a polygamist. Let's just think this through. In order to accomplish something that God has promised, they have to go outside of the will of God to help God out to accomplish something that he has promised. Does any of this make sense? Hagar agrees to marries Abram, becomes pregnant from this endeavor, and this fixes everything. Now the situation is perfect. Is that what we see here? No. In fact, now it makes things even worse. And so, because now everyone knows who in the couple is the one that struggles with infertility. And that person's name does not rhyme with Brabram. And so we see in verse 4, speaking of Hagar, saw that she had conceived, she looked with contempt at her or on her mistress, speaking of Sarai. And Sarai said to Abram, "May the wrong done to me be on you. I gave my servant to your embrace, and when she saw that she had conceived, she looked on me with contempt. And may the Lord judge between you and me." But Abram said to Sarai, "Behold, your servant is in your power. Do to her as you please." And then Sarai dealt harshly with her, and she, speaking of Hagar, fled from her. So notice that at some point, Hagar, the servant who had married Abram, was then demoted back down to servant. Sarai begins mistreating Hagar, and it gets to the point where Hagar is like, "I am out of here." Hagar leaves town and decides she's headed back down to Egypt, and she gets part of the way. But the problem with getting from Canaan to Egypt is that there's a big desert in the middle there. And so she goes and likely is short on water and ends up at this well. And now we're going to see there's this angel that appears before. Technically in the language, in Hebrew, it's the word messenger, which I'll talk about in a moment. And this is what happens in verse 11. "And the angel of the Lord said to her, 'Behold, you are pregnant and shall bear a son. You shall call his name Ishmael, because the Lord has listened to your affliction. He shall be a wild donkey of a man, his hand against everyone, and everyone's hand against him. And he shall dwell over against all his kinsmen.'" Now Ishmael, the name Ishmael means God hears. So God is telling her that he has heard her cry, that he has heard her difficulty. But at the same time, she needs to then go back and submit to the lady that mistreated her, which is strange. God's saying, "I hear what you're saying. I'm here to support you, but go back to Sarai," which is strange how God sometimes leads us into difficulty, not just always away from it. But did you catch that prophecy given about Ishmael? that he's going to be a wild donkey of a man. So God hears her cry, and therefore he's going to give her a son, this wild son, that's going to be against everyone. How in the world is that a compliment? By the way, there's some that believe that Ishmael is the sort of the father of the Arabian Muslims, which would then point to the Muslims going against Israel now even to this day. And we have then Isaac who's about to be born. So they're even to this day, possibly, if that is true, then we have these people going against each other thousands of years later. But how is it that she's encouraged, we'll say, by him being a donkey, by him being wild? And the answer is, I have no idea. But I'm thinking that this is just my thought, I'm thinking that she probably does not like Abram and Sarai very much. And so the thought of this man being independent and strong and being against them maybe gives her encouragement. I don't know. It's just my thought there. But whatever it is, she likes what the angel says. And so, verse 13, so she called the name of the Lord who spoke to her, "You are a God of seeing," for she said, "Truly here I have seen him who looks after me." Therefore, the well was called Be'er Lahai Roy. And so after this, Hagar returns home to Abram and Sarai, and she gives birth to Ishmael. And that's as far as we'll get in our passage. It's the end of chapter 16. And so I want to ask you today, with everything that we've just read, and we've seen Abram and Sarai make a mess out of their lives through trying to help God out, I want to ask you, where are you tempted to help God out? So where are you trying to help God, where you think he needs it? Now, I want to put it in sort of two categories. First of all, maybe you have good intentions, and you're trying to do something that will bring glory to God, and it's not happening. So the temptation is to help God out in the good things you're trying to do. You just don't see how God's going to do what you think he's calling you or telling you to do. Now, in my own life, I've shared how when I was in seminary, I was about to graduate from seminary, and in 2008, the housing market crashed, and there was a recession going on, and so no one wanted to hire me. And so I sent out my resume to hundreds of churches, literally hundreds of churches, in the months leading up to graduation, and then in the year after graduation, and no one wanted me. No one wanted me. And so from my perspective, what I was wanting to do seemed like it was a good thing because I wanted to serve God in the church. So surely God would help me out with this. I was willing to take just about any position anywhere that he led us to go, other than being a worship leader because I'm not very good at singing, and being a youth pastor because I'm not crazy. And so other than those two things, I was willing to go anywhere and do anything. And it just seemed like during that year or two, as I waited, God was leaving me hanging. Now, during that time, I could have, we'll say, helped God out. I could have maybe have made my resume look a little better than it really was, given myself a little more experience than I actually had. Or during the interviews that I would occasionally have, I could have made myself look better. You know, they always ask, so tell me, how's your devotional life? And I could have said, I'm a little tired because I woke up this morning at 4 a.m. to pray from 4 a.m. to 8 a.m. And then I spent the rest of the morning up to noon reading the Bible. So I'm just really tired right now. Now, I could have lied like that to try to make myself look more impressive. But in the end, all that would have done, and that's what happens when we try to help God out, all it does is it brings us out of the will of God and makes it harder for us to follow after God. So by us trying to help God out, we don't really help him out. Now, the other group is maybe that there's some of you all here that what you're seeking to do is outside of the will of God, and you're just thinking that it's the will of God in a different way to get you to outside of the will of God. And let me explain what I mean here. So you think that you need to help God by doing things your own way to accomplish what you're seeking to do, maybe because you think God owes you. So for example, how many times have we heard in our culture about it making us happy, about being happy? Oh, if it makes you happy, go for it. They deserve to be happy. Our society, our culture is obsessed with happiness. And there's nothing wrong with happiness in and of itself, but the problem comes when you put happiness over the will of God. And so God never promised to make us happy at any cost if we follow him. In fact, Jesus said that in this world we will have tribulation when we follow him. And so while there is an aspect of happiness in following after God, happiness is not the end goal. Glorifying God is the end goal. And so when we get when we follow after happiness over God, we get ourselves into trouble. So here are a few examples that come to mind. Just because sex before marriage makes you happy doesn't mean that God's okay with us doing it. Just because stealing will bring you whatever you think you want that will make you happy doesn't mean that God approves of it. Just because cheating on a test in school will bring you a better grade, which maybe will get you into a better school, which may get you a better job later on, which may allow you to tithe more in church, does not mean that God's okay with those actions. Just because alcohol brings happiness to you, and it occasionally leads you to get drunk, but that's just that's sometimes, doesn't mean God's okay with it if it's leading you to getting drunk. And so I want to challenge you. Don't live like God depends on you, like you can do whatever you want and you think he owes you. You don't live like you know better than God. That's going to get you into trouble. And so as we start to think about wrapping this up, I want to ask, where is Christ in this passage? And this is sort of going to bring everything back together now. And we've talked about this in a number of different ways, but there was one part that stood out to me that I want to focus on for this passage. And there's some believe that the angel that came to Hagar is actually Jesus Christ coming before he came as a baby. So let me read what the commentary says. The Hebrew word for angel may also be translated messenger. There's an element of mystery about this figure. In chapter 19, verse 1, the two angels who arrive at Sodom resemble human beings. In 18:2, they're called men. When the angel of the Lord speaks, his words are perceived as being God's words. Therefore, the impression is given that the angel is identical with God. On this basis, some Christians believe that the angel of the Lord is the pre-incarnate Christ. Others, however, hold that the reference here is to an angel who is being commissioned to speak as God's representative, and so the angel's words are God's words. And so it's entirely possible that it's Jesus, pre-incarnate, coming to speak to Hagar, but we can't know for sure, and I don't think the passage here depends on it being Jesus. So regardless of whether it's Jesus or a messenger of Jesus, let's think about some of the bigger details of the story. So we have this woman who is struggling, and we have one who's been marginalized by other people. We have this woman who then is struggling and goes to a well for a drink and meets with either Jesus or someone representing Jesus. And this person, this heavenly person, tells her things that encourage her and bring her healing after hardship. Does any of that scenario sound familiar from the New Testament? Well, that's from John chapter 4. When Jesus meets with another woman at a well. And in John chapter 4, Jesus meets with this woman who is having a bad time of life. She's on her after her fifth husband. She's gone through 5 divorces, and she's living with someone that's not her husband. And she has this conversation with Jesus about worship, which we won't get into today, but after the conversation, the woman is amazed about Jesus because he's talking to her and showing all this sight and wisdom that he knows what's going on. And so she goes back into town, and she then tells them to go out and meet with Jesus. We see in John 4:39, many Samaritans from that town believed in him because of the woman's testimony. He told me all that I ever did. And that's why then, because the angel or Jesus, whoever it is, told Hagar all that she did, that's why she named it Be'er Lahai Roi, which means well of the living one who sees me. That's what the well is named there, where Hagar ended up. And so in both cases, we have this person, whether it be God or a messenger of God, meeting with a messed up woman. In both cases, God knows and God shows that he knows exactly what's going on in their life. Yet in both cases, God shows love to them. In both cases, God shows grace and mercy to both of them. And both times, both go away marveling at the encounter that they've just had. The reason I bring this up is because both stories at the well, Genesis 16 and John 4, reveal the character of Jesus, that he extends grace and mercy to the sinful and hurting. And so maybe in this sermon, as I've gone through, maybe you can identify with some of the examples that I've given earlier about trying to help God out. And if that's you, then I want you to know that he sees what you are doing. He knows you are trying to help him out and mess it up. Yet he will extend grace to you and mercy, even though he knows what you've done. So he is a God who sees. And he is a God who extends grace and mercy. Let me close with this. Most likely you've heard about LaGuardia Airport being in New York City, but you may not know much about the person who it's named after. Now, I'm going to say his name wrong, but it's Fiorello LaGuardia. How did I do? He was in the House of Representatives, and eventually he became the mayor of New York City. And a story is told of when LaGuardia was mayor, how during some of the worst days of the Depression. So he was there in the 1930s and 40s when America was struggling. And he was this very colorful, vibrant guy who was known to do things like ride on the fire truck when there were fires, accompany the police to as they raided speakeasies, or he would take an entire orphanage to a baseball game. So this was the type of person he was. And the story goes that one night he turned up at night court that served the poorest ward in the city, and LaGuardia came in and he dismissed the judge for the evening, and he took over over the bench himself. And so within a few minutes, there is this old woman that was brought before him and charged with stealing a loaf of bread. And she told LaGuardia that her daughter's husband had deserted her daughter, that her daughter was sick, and that her two grandchildren were starving. However, the shopkeeper, who had the bread stolen from him, refused to drop the charges because he said that she needed to be made an example of to prevent others from stealing. And so LaGuardia heard everything, and he sighed, and he turned to the woman, and he said, "I've got to punish you. The law makes no exception. $10 or 10 days in jail." But even as he was pronouncing that sentence, the mayor was already reaching into his pocket, and he pulled out a $10 bill and tossed it into his little fancy hat there that he had. And he said, "Here's a $10 fine, which I now remit." And then, "And furthermore," he says, "I'm going to fine everyone in this courtroom 50 cents for living in a town where a person has to steal bread so that her grandchildren can eat. Mr. Bailiff, collect the fines and give them to the defendant." And so, after they went around, collected 50 cents from the other criminals, from the policemen in there, and even the red-faced shopkeeper was fined. And so she was then handed about $40 or $50. As I read that story, I thought about how, in his own quirky way, what he was doing is representing what mercy and grace are. So mercy is not getting something that you deserve, not getting that punishment that you deserve. Grace is getting something you don't deserve. And Hagar ran from her master, and God extended grace to her. Hagar, while she was also the victim here, she was not sin-free. She showed contempt to Sarai, yet God showed grace and mercy to her. And then the woman at the well in John chapter 4 was a sinful woman that God also extended grace and mercy to. So church, this is the God that we follow. And so I want to just encourage you that when you mess up, when you try to help God out and end up making things worse, I want you to remember who God is. That he is a God of mercy and grace. So therefore, let's give him our lives. Let's follow him all that we can. And let's worship him because he truly deserves worship. And let's remember, as we go out of here, let's not try to think we know better than God. Let's not try to help God out. Let's trust and follow him. Worship team, you can come on up. Let's go ahead and let's pray.